We are now recording.
Okay. So I've got my gavel. And good morning. I'm going to go ahead and call this session of the City of Bainbridge Island Hearing Examiner to order. For the record, today is July 23rd, 2020 at 10 a.m. And we have one item on the agenda today. This is number PLN 51554-80M, and it's an appeal of an administrative decision that the city made in relation to a proposal that involves a former master plan. And all the parties are represented by council, so I'm going to curtail opening remarks and essentially let everyone get right into it. Before we got on the record, we were discussing some procedural matters, and essentially the parties agreed that the exhibits that were submitted to my office could be admitted without foundation or objection. And so just to be clear, the appellant submitted exhibits C1 through C9. Is that correct, Mr. Gorey?
A1 through A9.
Yes. Sorry. Yes, no. A1 through A8. Well, is it 8 or 9?
Oh, I think it's 8, actually.
Yeah, sorry. A1 through A8, and then the city was C1 through C9. Is that correct, Mr. Haney?
That is correct, Mr. Examiner.
And then Ms. Rogers, representing our intervener, there were no additional exhibits that were admitted.
That's correct.
Accurate? Great. So the exhibits have been addressed. Were there other procedural matters that folks wanted to address before we get started? I'll just start with Mr. Gorey.
Nothing for me, Mr. Examiner.
Okay, Ms. Rogers?
No.
And Mr. Haney?
I don't believe so. I assume my witnesses are logged in, but I can't see them. So I don't know if Ms. Lundgren can let us know if Ms. Tayara and Ms. Wright have logged in.
Ms. Yes, Tayara,
they're both logged in, yeah.
Great.
So I think the plan following the pre-hearing order I guess it was revised several times, but I believe we were going to first hear from the appellant and the appellant witnesses. But did any of the attorneys wish to make opening remarks before we start? Mr. Gorey?
Based on the pre-hearing order, I hadn't prepared that. I thought we were going to dive right into the just a closing argument, I think, will suffice.
That works for me. Mr. Haney, any interest in opening remarks?
No, I think as Mr. Gorey says, closing argument will suffice for us.
Ms. Rogers?
The same. Thank you.
Okay. So then with that, let me get my right binder out. Sorry, I've got so many binders on my table here. I'm going to turn it over to you, Mr. Gorey, to call the witnesses you intend on calling. I see you had Mr. Smith and Mr. Goldberg as potential witnesses. Will you be calling both today?
Certainly, Mr. Smith. I do not think we'll be calling Mr. Goldberg.
Okay.
So if we're ready.
I'm ready. If you want to bring him on. So we're going to, and is he maybe listed as, we can unmute the second Mr. Gorey.
Doppelganger down there.
So whoever's controlling it on there, so that side has to unmute and start the video. But they have those controls down at the bottom of their screen.
Assistance is on the way.
Okay.
One second,
Hayes. So they're still muted, so we just need them to unmute.
Okay, just a sec.
Can you unmute? That seems to be the only thing.
There we go. Perfect.
Okay.
Great. Can you hear us, Mr. Smith?
Yes, David is fine for if you want to be quite formal, and I'm ready to speak.
Great. I'm going to swear you in. Do you swear affirm to tell the truth in any testimony you give here today?
I do.
Great. Thank you for being here.
All right. Good morning, Mr. Smith. Could you please state your name for the record?
David Smith.
And what is your occupation, sir?
I'm a builder and developer, and the company that we do that work through is Central Highlands, of which I am the president.
Okay, and briefly, what's your education?
I have an undergraduate degree in business combined with agriculture at Chico State in California. And then after being a naval officer during Vietnam, I went back and got an MBA at San Diego State University.
Okay, and then what's your work experience specifically as it relates to development?
In 1973, I built my first 5 houses, so that probably tells you how old I am. And I was in the Navy in 68. Then we went into purchasing apartment buildings with some of my co-naval officers. And we were all out of work. So then I went back and got the GI Bill and got the MBA at San Diego State. But the pertinent projects, we did 9 or 10 projects in San Diego area from 73 to 91, and then moved up to Washington State, where we have done a number of projects. The city of Bremerton, Kitsap County, Poulsbo, and Bainbridge. The Bainbridge, we've done about 6 projects. We started with a project on anyway, we did a project where we had 9 self-help lots, which would be affordable, and working with the Kitsap County Housing Authority that combined with an open market portion of another 20 homes. And then we moved on to a project off of Ferncliff, which is 10 open market homes. Those were both plats. Then we moved to Stonecrest, which was done on a site plan review. It was a condominium, and that happens to be right next to the subject project of 45 units. And we're currently, there's been a couple of smaller projects in between on Bainbridge, that were done also all plats. And currently, which kind of gets us to part of our opening points and arguments regarding the issues, are the project of Wallace Cottages, which is a 19 platted project, as well as Madison Place, which is a platted project, both using the HDDP program, which is a housing design demonstration project, which involves more stringent environmental controls. There's bonus density for that, and so on. But I think the SEPA environmental, the traffic engineers, all of these have grown. Stonecrest, one of the things we're facing on the city of Bainbridge is increasing regulations, increasing hoops. For example, Stonecrest was a site plan review, did have a wetland, does have buffers, and we complied with all of that. There was no traffic study. There were very limited other reviews in the SEPA report, and the project went through in about 5 or 6 months. Now we getting to the current situation on our current projects.
Mr. Smith, can I just interject for a second?
Certainly.
Try to break this up into bite-sized pieces. Look, going back to your experience, that was a lengthy answer. How many years total have you been doing residential development?
Since 1973.
So, okay, 47-ish years.
Yes.
Okay, and then how many years have you been developing residential products on Bainbridge Island specifically?
21 years.
Okay, and I think you said you've done 6 projects, residential projects on Bainbridge?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, and then and you said, were those all plats or some, there was one or two condo developments in there?
We have one condominium development, which is Stonecrest, which I just went over. And Stonecrest is a condominium development, 45 units, that went through site plan review, which was very limited at the time. Did have SEPA, we did have a wetland there, and but it, the entire project went through and approved in about 6 months or a little bit less.
Okay, so just so I understand, so you've done affordable housing on Bainbridge, is that correct?
Yes, on Ferncliff Avenue, we did an entire project with the local housing authority, which is called Housing Resources Bainbridge, and it was done under the self-help program, and there was 24 homes in that project, and that was a plat, and it was done under the Housing Design Demonstration Project. And that project went through, when I arrived, it was floundering. And then when I was invited in, we got the project from start to finish, platting the whole deal in about 4 months. There was an urgency to it because their grant money was running out, and the city staff and myself and the council went to work, and we got it done in 4 months. That was done in 2012, 2013.
So, okay. And have you built single family residences on Bainbridge Island?
Yes. The single family, the only project that isn't single family is Stonecrest. All of the remaining projects are all single family detached projects, all in platted lots.
Okay, so in the course of the residential development on Bainbridge Island, you've gone through the site plan and design review process, I assume?
20 years old. The only one we've got, the only site plan review that we have gone through to date is the Stonecrest project, which is now approaching 20 years old.
Okay. And then I assume you've gone through the SEPA review process a time or two on Bainbridge Island?
All projects have SEPA review. But as the time has elapsed, SEPA and the issues in it have been more contested. They've resulted in controversy that had to be resolved. All of those issues of increasing regulations have changed the time frame from 6 months back when we did Stonecrest and the two earlier projects to now the process, a full-blown process on a project that meets all the zoning, all the regulations, is our current projects both took over 2 years to complete the process.
Okay. I assume in the course of your development on Bainbridge and elsewhere, you've worked extensively with environmental consultants, is that correct?
Absolutely. We have the projects. The first project that we did won the Green Building Award. We decided as a company with my partner that we would adopt green building procedures. And as a president of our local Home Builders Association, we also created a pioneer green building program called Built, which eventually got adopted by the National Association and got renamed to the Built Green Program.
And but that's laudable, Mr. Smith. I just want to jump in and request that we try to keep our answers a little bit briefer. We're trying to get through to the current issues at stake. So
I'm ready.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Jammer. Just Mr. Smith has been disclosed as a fact witness, of course, but also an expert witness. So I'm just laying a foundation for that. So that I think that's sufficient foundation to establish him as an expert witness in the area of general residential construction, and I would tender him as such.
No issue from me.
The first issue that we need to talk about is, I'm sorry. Oh,
David, Mr. Smith, let me lead with the questions, okay?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. All right. And one other quick, I guess, foundational question. In your experience developing on Bainbridge Island, do you have experience with the floor area ratio and how that is applied to developments?
I do, on the residential and commercial.
Okay. All right. Just let's turn briefly to your contractual arrangement with the Visconti Group. And I use the term Visconti Group, you know, kind of colloquially to refer to the intervener in this action, just so everybody's clear on that. Just to give us a sense, what is the current status of your contractual arrangement with the Visconti Group?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, question to you.
Repeat the question. I didn't hear it clearly.
Oh, what's the status of your contractual arrangement with the Visconti
Group? Okay, got it. We are under contract to purchase the Visconti two lots, and we could bring up that drawing perhaps to show the hearing examiner where the two lots are, so that'll also lead into the FAR. So we're under contract to purchase the two lots. We have terms in there allow us to go to this hearing, and if it turns out that we need to, we could continue on to a LUPA action. And we have 9 months. We have 3 3-month options, so we have a total of 9 potential months to resolve any difficulties and hopefully arrive at an approval.
Okay, yeah, let's turn to exhibit A5, if we could. I'm not sure how the Zoom works, if it's gonna be put up on the screen or if everyone's just gonna refer to it themselves.
I think you have the capacity to do that if you'd like, Mr. Gorey. I have the exhibits myself, but you can share screen if you so desire.
Oh, okay. It might be beyond my technological capacity. I think it's fine. Everyone okay. has the exhibits, I would imagine. Okay, so turning our attention to exhibit A5, which is just kind of an aerial depiction of the entire site plan. Mr. Smith, if you could identify on exhibit A5 the two subject lots for us.
The two project sites they're identified as project site. They're two separate lots, and they're on my drawing, they are darker. Does everybody see that?
Yeah.
I think everyone's looking at the exhibit.
One's 1.63 acres and the other is 1.3 acres. So that's the size of the lots, and they're located between, you've got Virginia Mason on your left-hand side of the drawing, and then you've got the other two existing tenants, which are KeyBank and Walgreens on the right-hand lower corner there.
Okay, and it looks like, yeah, thank you. And it looks like the site, with the exception of the two subject parcels or two subject lots, is largely built out or entirely built out. Is that correct?
Everything is built out except the two subject parcels.
Okay, that include roads, sidewalks, utilities, et cetera?
Yeah, the entire site is completely developed, with the one exception, including storm sewer, water, roadways, with the one exception is the western site, which would be the site at the top project site, has their storm detention yet to be put in.
Okay. all right. Thank you for that. I assume, Mr. Smith, that you've read the hearing examiner's report and decision, dated March 27, 2014, which is
correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. And then the city included audio records of the Visconti hearing examiner proceedings as an exhibit C8. have you had occasion to listen to those audio records?
I have listened to 4 of the 5 tapes. The 5th tape was missing. The 4 tapes included about 20 hours, and I listened to those.
Okay, so there's the 5th tape missing, you said. What period?
Yeah, there was a public records request, and all that could be produced was the 4 tapes from the city of Bainbridge.
Okay, so that missing 5th tape.
Could not find the 5th tape.
Would that missing fifth tape be the end of the proceedings? Is that the time period?
The fifth tape, unfortunately, may have had some discussion about the issues of 49A and B, because the six of the conditions were add-ons by the hearing examiner beyond the recommended conditions in the staff report. So okay. we don't have any tape, or at least I don't have any tape to hear whether there was any explanation about 49A and B.
Okay, let's talk about your project submittals to date. It's correct that you submitted initially a multifamily apartment complex proposal. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Have you abandoned that, or are you still interested in pursuing that?
Under our two paths to proceed with the project, we believe that we can still have the right to do multifamily based on the city's recognition that you could put up to four units on one lot, or in our case, we have the second project of 44 lots which is our preferred project of 44 single family residences on 44 condominium lots.
Okay, and for those 44 condominium single family detached units, what are you thinking for the price point for those units?
It's going to be in the just around 500. What we would like to be under the $500,000 threshold to be the clear price leader in a home on a lot.
Okay, would that price point be deemed affordable housing on Bainbridge Island?
Yes. I have to put a caveat in there. At current interest rates, at 3.78, then the income guidelines in the COBE code for affordable housing, the highest bracket of that affordable housing would be able to qualify without any other debt, clean debt, obviously, would be able to afford to purchase the home.
Okay. And what's your understanding of the inventory of affordable housing on Bainbridge Island?
I believe we're the only projects that are affordable. And I should say that Bainbridge uses that term in two different ways. One, they have a strict income guidelines, and the other, with the HDDP, affordable means that we're building homes no bigger than 1,600 square feet, so they're affordable, even though our price point is way above. It's $700,000 on our current Wallace Cottages project.
Okay. Under your condo proposal, first of all, is the site for these two lots, is it zoned for residential under city code?
Both High School 1 and High School 2 Road are zoned for residential. Okay.
Okay, let's see here, I'm checking my list here, we've covered a lot.
We haven't talked about the FAR yet.
Okay, excellent, thank you very much. Well, actually, before we get to there, Mr. Smith, let's pull out Exhibit A6. And that is kind of a depiction of your proposed condo development with 44 single family residences. Is that correct?
Correct.
It looks like you're dividing it evenly between the two lots, 22 on one, 22 on the other.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, great. Yeah, let's move on to floor area ratio. And we have submitted an exhibit, which is A7. And that's somewhat wordy, admittedly. But what's the point of Exhibit A7 with respect to your proposed condo project?
I don't happen to have A7 in front of me, but that demonstrates that floor area ratio in the high school one and the high school two road, as well as the MUTC zone Madison overlay, which where our current Madison Avenue project is, which was a plat, and we're talking about how floor area ratio can be allocated to lots. And in Madison Place, according to the city, because the project included a plat as we were going through, the floor area ratio is calculated on the entire property, including any streets, any open space, just from within its property lines. Then the lots are imposed on that property, but the lots in this case are very small in order to accommodate the streets and the open space. But the FAR is allocated by dividing 18 into the percentage of the total area. So what happens is the lots themselves cannot support a percentage of 3% or 6% with a bonus, because the house floor area in many cases is almost as big as the lot. So what that demonstrates is that the developer, when there's a plat included, gets to distribute the floor area based on the whole project as he deems appropriate for his project.
Well, Mr. Schmidt, just so I understand what you just said there. So you're talking about your Madison Place development on Bainbridge Island for
correct
an example. Is that to say that in that project, that for on a given lot, if we took 30% of the square footage, the building on that lot exceeds that number?
Correct.
Okay, and that's based on the allocation ability that you just described on the part of the developer?
Yeah, and when we get into the Visconti one, it may be easier to understand, or the hearing examiner to understand FAR by looking at A5 when we get into Visconti.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and let's pull out Exhibit A5 and what's your thinking on the FAR allocation with respect to the two subject lots?
Okay. The floor area ratio for the Visconti project also starts both with residential and commercial by taking the entire land area of the project, 8.1 acres, I believe, is what it is, and then it's distributed. In this case, the city is saying that it is distributed in accordance with the individual lots, rather. So in order to have FAR fit your project, which the hearing examiner allowed in the decision, you could manipulate the property lines in order to get enough FAR. I believe that the hearing examiner did not fully understand how FAR actually works when there are lots, individual parcels on the project. This is so because if the project would never be able to be fully built out in accordance with their allowed uses and floor area. Once you start, if you have a building a commercial building, which doesn't require very much parking, but has a whole bunch of floor area, then you're going to need a very big lot to handle that floor area. So looking at the project, suppose you have a building which is fairly small, but requires huge amount of parking. Well, what would happen is that would use up so much FAR that the poor developer would never be able to build a big building with a large amount of floor area ratio. So he would be denied the full development rights of his project. And the lot lines, let me go one step further. In the Visconti project, you have to have lots, because if you lease a project, lease a unit, and it's going to have a separate building with a separate amount of financing, or if you need to sell to a particular user, then you must have lot lines. So the ability to manipulate lot lines disappears at that point. So going back to my example, and Mr. Hearing Examiner, do you understand about the difficulty of being not allowed to distribute commercial FAR if you had a big building with little parking and you had Does that make sense to you?
I understand the argument. My confusion at the moment is you've referenced a different project multiple times, Madison Place. The exhibits you've referenced don't appear to be what I have, so I'm confused as to what we're referencing. Okay. I have exhibit A7 as something listed as floor area ratio for residential development, and it's very clearly a breakdown of your view of, I think, the Visconti site plan. But the reference to, I just wasn't sure what the discussion of Madison Place, what the exhibit you were referencing was. Okay. Mr. Gorey, can you clarify that for me? Am I missing something?
Well, sure. Thank you, Mr. Examiner. So let's start with exhibit A7. Do you have it now, Mr. Smith?
Yep.
Okay, and this pertains to the Visconti project, correct?
Yep.
Okay, And it looks like it's essentially a lot of math, and I know lawyers don't like math, but essentially it's a calculation to show, if we were just looking at actual lot square footage, what the shortfall is, for your 44 unit condo project. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and what is the shortfall? I think it's at the very bottom, based on lot size.
It's the with just the allocated 30%, mm-hmm. you get 38,551, which is the line second from the bottom. And on the bottom line, in order to build the proposed project, we need another 23,000 square feet, which we are maintaining is available to us on the Visconti project. So on the other parcels that are already who have used only commercial FAR. You get both, the project is entitled to all, both commercial FAR and residential FAR. And Josh Macon, the planner, testified to that in the tape. And I believe the hearing examiner also ratified that in comments himself in the actual decision, that the developer has the right to all of the FAR for both residential and commercial.
Do you have a site for that in the decision?
Say it again.
Does anyone know where in the decision that was? In the 70-page decision. I read it this morning, and it's not ringing a bell to me, but if someone knows where that's cited, let me know.
Mr. Examiner.
The city's not contesting this, are you, Jim?
Mr. Examiner, I don't think that provision is in the hearing examiner's Visconti decision. I don't think the hearing examiner's Visconti decision deals with residential FAR, and that's been our position all along.
Sure. I think Mr. Smith was referring to the audio tapes, if I may. Right. Yeah. And so
It's on the 20 hours of audio that I have not listened to as the appellant. You know, it was your burden, and nobody directed me to anything in the audio as to look at hour 18 and a half. You know, I'm not going to bill Bainbridge Island 20 hours to on a goose chase. So if you know about where in the audio it is, please let me know. But my recollection of an hour ago reading the decision was there was no reference to any of this. So.
Right. Yes. Thank you. And I didn't want to bill my client 20 hours either, frankly. Okay. So he's just testifying his recollection.
of the audio tapes, which he listened to. So let's, David, you bring up a point about the notion that residential and commercial floor area ratio are independent of each other, and using one doesn't cannibalize the other. Is that your understanding?
Absolutely, and I don't know that when the project started, it was entitled to 30% of the total land area for residential. It was entitled to 30% of the total land area for commercial. It was entitled to purchase another 30% of residential. So before they submitted the site plan, they certainly had the legal right to a total of 90% of the 8.1 acres to build on that project if they could fit it in there in accordance with all the other rules that exist surrounding the development of that project. And
okay. And then under city code, is it possible for a developer to obtain additional floor area ratio?
Yes. Madison Place, the project that we're doing currently, that we apparently still have a little confusion on how FAR works there. We are allowed to and did purchase the maximum bonus of 30%. So we started with 30%, and we got another 30% by purchasing it from the Island Mobile Home Park, which they have the authority to sell under a contract with the city their bonus FAR to anybody they want to.
Okay, so you're saying that you can purchase, you know, from the Mobile Home Association or other entity additional FAR to get an additional 30% on top of the original 30%?
Correct. So we have a way. Right now, according to the city, we are only allowed 30% of the square footage in those two lots, which comes out to 38,000 square feet and a little more. And we are maintaining that we have the right to acquire additional FAR up to 30% more from the other lots that already are built on Visconti, or from the Island Mobile Home Park, or from the city itself, for that matter.
Have you taken any steps with respect to the Visconti project for purchasing additional or bonus FAR?
We have conversations. We have not arrived at a price. In case our argument fails that we have a right to the FAR without paying for it, because we believe it's fluid and can go to the two lots without any other encumbrance. But as a backup, we have already started negotiations with the Islander Mobile Home Park to purchase the 23,000 square feet that we need. We have not concluded, but we've already made a purchase for Madison Place, which we were happy with, and the indications are they'll sell us it at the same, that what we need for Visconti at the same price.
Okay, and have you submitted an application for that bonus FAR to the city?
That's a good question, but I can't remember if we have or not.
Okay, all right.
For Madison Place or for?
No, for Visconti. Did you submit a submission to the city?
We did, because if you look at figure A6, which is our proposed 44 units, that project requires the additional 23,000 square feet. A6 shows a project with the 44 units, and it, of course, it's not the scale, but if it was, you'd be able to figure out that the square footage of the additional 23,000 is included there. So in that fashion, we have applied for it.
Okay. Well, in the city's brief, it's in a footnote, I believe, they mentioned that the city council recently amended the Bainbridge Island Municipal Code chapter about transfer development rights.
Did you submit your notice to the city of the desire to purchase bonus FAR for Visconsin before the city council enacted the changes?
Now that you give me a better clue, that's correct. And of course you wrote it and I signed it, said it.
Okay, and that was sent in before the city council
yes,
enacted the changes?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, we heard about, there were rumors and so we hurried up and did it.
And generally speaking, the changes that the city council has made to that chapter 18.27 of the municipal code, those changes make it easier or harder for property owners to transfer floor area ratio?
Our understanding is that the refusal to allow transfers of FAR was another move to hinder the development of particularly residential. I don't know, I'm almost certain it was aimed to reduce the size of residential projects in the core. So that seemed to me to be in opposition to the comprehensive plan goal of having much more density and having as much residential develop on Bainbridge Island in the core so it wouldn't affect the rural character of the island.
Mr. Gorey, are you concerned that I'm going to be making a ruling related to vesting that nobody ever asked me to make? I'm trying to understand this line of thinking.
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I'm just laying a foundation for some argument that I intend to make.
Okay.
I'm ready to move on.
I'm trying to understand where we're going.
Yep, understand. Okay, one more question, because Mr. Examiner, you asked about what was the point of the Mr. Smith's discussion of Madison Place. And Mr. Smith, you were talking about how for your project on Bainbridge Island here, right in the downtown core, you as the developer are able to allocate the residential FAR to various lots within the plat. And what was your point in talking about that?
The point is, and I'm addressing the hearing examiner's questions that he couldn't quite relate to the Madison Avenue project, but the Madison Avenue project individual lots cannot support the units that have been placed on them because they're way bigger than even the combined 30% and bonus 30%. They are based strictly on dividing the 18 lots into the total land area, which includes streets, buffer areas, so that you get total land. Then, in that case, we do make it. So it's in other words, the lot lines and the lots are irrelevant in the distribution of the overall 30% plus 30% bonus of the 60% of the total land area of Madison Place is distributed regardless of the lot lines. And my point in comparing that to the Exhibit A5 is that the city maintains that we must calculate FAR on only the land area in the two dark colored project sites, that we don't get to use any of the other FAR residential that remains on the three commercial properties.
And just to be clear, my confusion wasn't the concept you're promoting. It was, is there an exhibit that was being referenced that went into detail about the Madison Place project? It sounded like when you started talking, you were citing to an exhibit. And I was digging through my file and I couldn't find anything about Madison Place. I just want to make sure I'm not missing anything.
Was an oops.
Sorry. Okay. I think we've covered floor area ratio. Mr. Smith, based on your having listened to the 20 hours or so of the audio recordings of the 2014 proceedings, what's your understanding whether there was a clamor or an interest in a residential component to the Visconsin site plan? Just input from the public.
The the 20 or 30 witnesses almost unanimously were advocating that the commercial be combined with residential component. They cited the comprehensive plan, that this is, they cited just all kinds of different things, but in particular, they hammered on the comprehensive plan that we're supposed to have residential there because the residential is supposed to be included in all these projects so we can get more residential downtown. So they are, houses aren't far flung, we reduce yada, 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 smart growth principles. It would obey smart growth principles as well as the comp plan. And the hearing examiner and Mr. Haney's welcome to contradict me, but the hearing examiner was sympathetic to that. And we believe that he too questioned why there wasn't any residential, and the Viscontis apparently didn't want it. And so, or didn't see it as a viable option at that point. And so they, it went on with the current ruling, but that we feel that may have affected the hearing examiner's, Stafford Smith's, thinking when he created the additional six conditions, including 49 A and B, to make it possible that if the developers, the Visconti, determined that it would be appropriate, that they couldn't make it go entirely commercial, they'd have a simple way to get to residential.
Okay, Mr. Smith, I'm, you know, as an expert in general residential construction, I'm wondering, generally speaking, if when you convert from a commercial development to a residential development, does that increase or decrease environmental impacts for a given project?
In every instance on the questions in the SEPA report, the residential, in particular, I suppose there could be some residential thing, it could be worse, but the two projects we've submitted would have less impact in all categories, and especially the category that was the hot point all the way through, which is traffic impact. The traffic impact of our residential project would be far less than what Stafford Smith cited as the maximum allowable impact, which was five trips during the high traffic period, peak hour traffic per 1,000 square feet. So our proposed project of 44 units, typically a residential unit has in the core, walking distance to the ferry, has about one traffic count during the peak hour traffic. So our 44 units would have 44 peak hour traffic count. But if you took the two proposed buildings on those two lots, as you're looking at A5, they total about 22,000 square feet. And if you took the hearing examiner's maximum limit of five trips per 1,000 feet, that would come out to over 100 peak hour trips for those two projects compared to our 44. So on the most important impact that the public was concerned about, our 44 units would be less than half the impact. Is that clear?
Yes, I thank you.
I'm worried about the hearing examiner being clear.
Oh, okay.
I'm following.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Smith. I have no more questions.
I'm going to see if Ms. Rogers had questions. You guys are kind of on the same side, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Haney after that to see if he has cross-examination.
I have nothing for Mr. Smith.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Haney, cross-examination?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Examiner. Mr. Smith, I just want to confirm the nature of your purchase at the present time. You are purchasing two specific lots from Visconti, is that correct?
Yes.
Do you have any ownership interest in any of the other lots in the Visconti site plan?
No.
Have you entered into any agreements with Visconti to purchase unused FAR from the other lots in the site plan?
The answer to that is a little loosey-goosey, to put it in that way.
Well, let me rephrase the question, Mr. Smith.
Okay.
Does your purchase and sale agreement with Visconti specifically provide for the purchase of unused FAR from other lots within the Visconti site plan?
I believe, and Nancy Rogers and can confirm, but I believe it is referenced in there that we are going to need additional FAR, and if it's possible, they will transfer available FAR to us to meet our needs. And the actual means of doing that, I do not recall being detailed.
Do you recall where that is in the purchase and sale agreement, Mr. Smith?
I do not. Nancy may be familiar with that.
Have you approached any of the other owners of lots within the Visconti site plan in order to purchase unused FAR from those properties?
No.
Now, Mr. Smith, you talked about purchasing some FAR from the Islander Mobile Home Park. Is that correct?
Yes.
Are those the FAR that you would purchase from the Islander Mobile Home Park? Is that part of the bonus FAR provisions in the Bainbridge Island Municipal Code?
Yes.
And as far as you know, Mr. Smith, are the lots in the Visconti site plan subject to the same bonus FAR requirements or ability to sell as the Islander Mobile Home Park is?
You better repeat it. I didn't quite grasp the...
Well, I think you said that the Islander Mobile Home Park was able to sell bonus FAR under the provisions of the code relating to bonus FAR. That's correct. That's what you said?
Okay. Yes, correct.
Are the lots in the Visconti site plan able to sell bonus FAR under those same provisions, to the best of your knowledge?
Yes.
Mr. Smith, isn't it true that the Bainbridge Island Code defines FAR in terms of the percentage of the gross area of the individual lot?
And apparently you did not completely understand my explanation about Madison Place. The answer is there is nothing in the code that I have found that doesn't allow a entire project that happens to have lots from distributing the FAR at will. It is true.
Mr. Smith,
you want me to finish or not?
Well, Mr. Smith, I understand what you're saying, but my question to you is, with respect to the Madison development that you were talking about, wasn't the FAR distributed prior to the finalization of the subdivision and the creation of the lots?
No. It all happens at final plat, Mr. Haney.
Okay, I understand. But final plat, Mr. Smith, isn't that when lots are created?
Let's get straight to the conundrum. And the issue is whether or not, if you arrive with a project, an 8.1 project, which has five parcels on it, is that going to be treated differently than a project where you arrive in combination with producing a plat? And as far as I can tell, the Bainbridge Island Code, they are not differentiated. Now, you're telling me that because the lots arrived with the project already laid out, already platted, because they didn't do a plat process with it, that now you are bound to only allow the FAR to be calculated on each one of those parcels. But you need to remember that the hearing examiner himself laid out a method for that to be fluid. You could do BLAs as necessary to move that FAR and allow FAR. My point to the hearing examiner and you all, did you want to interrupt?
Well, Mr. Smith, I'm just trying to get you to answer my question. Once lots are established as part of a subdivision, or as part of, or once lots exist, is it your contention that you can transfer density up between those lots at will? Or is it your testimony that the FAR can only be allocated prior to the actual establishment of the lots?
My position is it doesn't make any difference when the lots were created, that you can, in fact, move FAR around at will, whether or not you arrived with the lots already in place on a single project. The hearing examiner himself made the point that the project was to be considered as an 8-acre project, not...
Well, I understand, Mr. Smith, that the project at the time was an 8-acre project. But where in the hearing examiner's decision does it say that you can transfer FAR once the property, once the site plan is approved? Where does it say that?
Well, he doesn't need to say it. It's not, he doesn't need to make up law. He has to go back to the COBE code, as do we all.
Okay, Mr. Smith, where in the COBE code does it say that you can transfer density between parcels? They are created.
I'm not sure, but it does exist, or else I wouldn't have been able to do it on Madison Place.
Okay, so
the question remains, it's whether you arrive with the plat in at the same time or the plat's already done when you get there. That's all we're arguing about, Mr. Haney, is because the project arrived with five lots already existing, then they're denied the ability to move the floor area around. That's what we're arguing about.
I understand that, but you do not have any specific cite to the code which you can point to, which says that the density can be transferred between the lots.
It can in Madison Place. So it is allowed in the code. There are lots in place. So anyway, let's just agree that we can disagree on that point.
Okay, Mr. Smith, you testified regarding condition 49, A and B, and what you believe the hearing examiner meant those conditions to cover. And I believe you said, Mr. Smith, that it was your feeling that the hearing examiner was trying to allow the kind of flexibility for residential use that you're here testifying about. But Mr. Smith, where specifically in the hearing examiner's decision does it say that?
It doesn't need to. The Stafford, as you know, is extremely knowledgeable about the Bainbridge Code, the Paulsbow Code, all the codes wherever he's been the hearing examiner. You don't need to because single family residential exemption exists. He knows residential is allowed on the project. Even your plan, hear me out, Mr. I get to finish my question answer. The planning director herself noted that under Washington state law, you can build up to 4 units, regardless, it's exempt. Under state law, you can build 4 units on that project. There's no question that residential is allowed, regardless of the site plan. That's the law. So
Mr. Smith, my question to you is, where in the hearing examiner's decision on the Visconti property does it indicate that one can convert from commercial to residential under condition 49A or B?
It says change in use. And change in use typically, and again, the hearing examiner is knowledgeable. He knows what change in use means. You don't have change in use from one retail use to another retail use. You don't have change in use from one commercial use to another. Typically, when you get down to specific, change in use is to something other than the approved uses. Why would you have a change in use on an approved use?
But didn't the hearing examiner say, Mr. Smith, that the change in use that he was talking about, at least an example he gave, was the change from medical to commercial retail?
He called that a conversion, if I recollect. He used both terms in that sentence. So I agree that 49A, he may have left it a little loosey-goosey because he was flirting with changing a process that the city does for change in use. But I believe he was opening the door for true change in use to one of the allowed uses in the zones.
And just to be sure, Mr. Smith, I believe you said that you had listened to the tapes, but you didn't find anything on the tapes you were able to listen to relating to condition 49. Is that correct?
True. Correct.
So there was no discussion on the tapes you were able to listen to where the hearing examiner opined about what condition 49 would be.
That's correct.
I think that's all I have for Mr. Smith.
Okay. Any redirect based on that, Mr. Gorey?
Yeah, thank you. Just a quick question. So, Mr. Smith, is it correct that you made a public records request for the audio recordings of the Visconti proceedings?
I did, and I only received 4. The unfortunately, the tape that might shed some light on this is not available.
Okay, so the reason you weren't able to listen to the last portion of the Visconti proceedings is because the city wasn't able to produce that last tape. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. No more questions.
Ms. Rogers, any redirect based on what you've heard? Okay, I think then that would conclude Mr. Smith's testimony.
Yes.
Great, thank you for being here, Mr. Smith. Your next witness, Mr. Gorey?
Appellant Rest, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Haney, do you need a second? Well, it's not like you can really confer with anyone. You're not in the same room.
No, that is a little bit difficult. I do agree. Give me just a moment.
Sure.
Okay, we do have 2 witnesses. We're going to call Kelly Tyrara and Heather Wright. We will not be calling Mr. Machen or Ms. Hitch.
Okay.
And we did let Mr. Gorey know that in advance of the hearing, so he was aware of that.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I see they're both available as attendees. Is there a specific order you wanted to proceed?
Yes,
with?
I'd like to begin with Ms. Tyrara, please.
Okay. So if we can unmute Ms. Tyrara at this point.
Hello.
Hello. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. I'm going to put you under oath. Do you swear affirm to tell the truth in any testimony you give here today?
I do.
Great. Thank you. And I'll hand you over to Mr. Haney at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner. Good morning, Ms. Tayara.
Good morning.
I'd like to begin by having you state your full name and spell your last name for the record.
Colleen Elizabeth Kelly Tayara, T-A-Y-A-R-A.
And what is your current position with the City of Bainbridge Island?
Senior Planner.
How long have you been in that position?
I don't know.
Can you tell me how long you've worked for the City of Bainbridge Island?
I believe it's 17 years.
Okay. And what are the duties of your current position?
I review projects for consistency with zoning code, critical areas, shoreline, the projects run the gamut, everything from dog parks to historic preservation, subdivisions, site plan reviews, conditional use permits, variances. We have a small staff, so we do everything.
And can you give me an idea? And I realize you've been there 17 years, so this is a big ask, but can you give me an idea of how many projects you've been involved in over the years? Would it be in the dozens, hundreds?
Hundreds.
And can you give us basically summarize your education and planning experience other than with Bainbridge Island?
My education is a Bachelor of Science in Accounting. I was an accountant for a long time. I was given the opportunity after working with the planning director. I had some prior experience with housing authorities and building in my past experience. So one of the prior directors thought I would be very good as a planner. So kind of brought me along over a period of about 4 years. So gave me the opportunity to learn on the job, as it were, to attend trainings, things like that. So I don't have a formal education in planning.
But you have 17 years of experience.
I've worked for the city for 17 years. I've been a planner for approximately 14 of those, 13 or 14.
And can you tell me what your prior experience has been in interpreting the Bainbridge Island Municipal Code?
I'd say it's rather extensive. The code is I would say frequently conflicts, say, with the comprehensive plan, or is not as clear as one might hope. So we frequently, as staff members, have to interpret the code and rely on peers and management team and the director for guidance with that. And I think that's all I have to say.
Okay. Can you tell me when an applicant or a non-city employee asks for an interpretation of the city code, what is the process for doing that?
There is a formal land use application. We call it the master land use application, and they indicate on there, one gets a choice of perhaps 25 different permits, and the applicant would mark administrative interpretation, and there are submittal requirements for that. So they have to identify what the request is, provide some supplemental documentation, and then they pay the fee, submit the application, and we evaluate it. Staff evaluates it and makes a recommendation to the director generally.
And does the director make the final decision on code interpretations?
Yes.
Okay. In this particular case, were you assigned the code interpretation or interpretation relating to the Wintergreen Apartments proposal or this proposal that we're talking about with Mr. Smith?
Yes, it was a request for administrative interpretation.
Okay, and what would you say, or what was your role in making the administrative interpretation?
It was to respond to the request from the proponent from Central Highlands. So it was to draft an administrative interpretation. There were some complexities with that because it wasn't quite an administrative interpretation of the code. So it was a little unusual in that.
But your job was to draft the administrative interpretation for the director, is that correct?
That's correct.
And is that your administrative interpretation issued January 10th of 2020 and it's City's Exhibit C7?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Tayara, prior to drafting your interpretation, did you do some research into the Visconti master plan approval or site plan approval?
Yes.
What generally did you review to make your interpretation?
I reviewed the hearing examiner's decision, the appeal documents, the reconsideration documents. I reviewed the staff recommendation prepared by Josh Machen. I reviewed, did you ask just
I'm just asking you generally what you reviewed at this point.
Okay, and I also researched the municipal code, especially with regard to provisions for site plan review, amendments to site plan reviews. In general, I don't recall anything else specifically, but I'd have to look at the look at each of the responses in the interpretation.
Okay, so Ms. Tayara, you said that you reviewed the hearing examiner's decision on the Visconti master plan, correct?
Yeah.
And that's Exhibit C1.
I'd have to try to pull up something else on my screen.
Okay, but you said you, well, I know it's hard in these kinds of hearings to do this stuff, so I'll just try to make it simple. We've already admitted all of the exhibits. So you did review the hearing examiner's decision. Did you say you also reviewed the hearing examiner's reconsideration?
I did.
Decision. Did you also look at the site plans?
Yes.
Did you review the traffic study?
Not extensively. I reviewed it enough to understand what the scope, the transfer group didn't call it the scope, but essentially the scope of that traffic plan, yes.
Did you review the project narrative relating to the proposal?
I believe so. Again, I can pull up, I have notes on it, but I have to pull that up on my screen. I can try to look at that very quickly. But I believe it was, I remember looking at what was considered. So it was commercial development, and they called it a mix of uses. It was all commercial though, and there was no residential, there was nothing about residential development in there. That's really all I was looking for.
Okay, well, let me ask you specifically about that. Let's begin with the Visconti hearing examiner's decision. What was your understanding of what the decision approved?
It approved a, my understanding of it is that it was a approval of a commercial complex with seven buildings on five parcels, which totaled 8.16 acres, along with associated parking spaces.
Was there anything in the decision that you reviewed that indicated there was a residential component to the development that was approved?
No.
And you said that you looked at the site plans for the proposal. What generally did those site plans show? And again, here I'm talking about the Visconti master plan, not the current Wintergreen plan.
Yes, I understand. The Visconti site plan depicted, to put it simply, seven buildings on the five lots. While some of the buildings were kind of across lot lines and things. So there was, yeah.
Do you know what the site plan showed specifically for the lots that now Central Highlands is proposing to develop?
I don't recall, no.
Was there any residential component shown on the site plans?
No.
You said that you looked at the scope of the traffic study. Was there any residential development included in the scope of that traffic study?
No.
And as far as the project narrative is concerned, was there any residential component that you can recall being part of the project narrative?
No.
You said that, did you also review the Wintergreen Apartments proposal that Central Highlands submitted? This is a proposal, I believe, for 100 to 140 apartment units. Do you recall that?
I don't recall. Are you asking about a site plan when you say proposal?
I'm asking if, I guess maybe it's not a proposal. Let me ask, in the interpretation or the request for interpretation that you received, did that relate to an apartment proposal?
It was a request for a 100 to 140 unit apartment project.
And is there a 100 to 140 unit apartment project shown anywhere on the site plans approved with the Visconti master plan?
No.
Now, do you have an understanding of that Central Highlands is also possibly seeking to develop a 44 unit condominium proposal? Are you familiar with that?
Condominium proposal. Not per se. I've had many discussions with them on various different, to put it loosely, proposals. Going back to early 2019.
Are there any condominiums shown on any of the materials you reviewed relating to the Visconti site plan?
No.
Now, Ms. Tayara, you described the process, and I'm just going to cut short here because I don't want to duplicate testimony of my witnesses. So I'm just going to ask you, in terms of your interpretation, which is exhibit. C7, you drafted your original interpretation and took it to the director, is that correct?
That's correct.
Did the director make any changes in your proposed interpretation?
I don't recall.
Did you and the director agree on the interpretation?
Yes.
And did you review your interpretation in preparation for the hearing here today?
I did.
And do you still stand by the statements in your interpretation and the interpretation you made?
Yes.
Okay. I have no further questions for Ms. Tayara at this time. I do plan to cover the interpretation in more detail with Ms. Wright.
Okay. Mr. Gorey, did you have cross-examination of this witness?
Yes, thank you. A couple questions. good morning, Ms. Tayara.
Good morning.
I wanted to follow up on that question about the condo project that Central Highlands has submitted. Isn't it correct that they've submitted a project and actually paid some building permit application fees in connection with that?
I'm not aware of a condominium. There are some building permits that were submitted for these parcels.
Okay, and that was in connection with this proposed 44 unit condominium development, correct?
I don't know.
Okay, and do you have Exhibit A6 handy?
A6, if you'll bear with me, I'll try to pull that up.
Yeah, it's an Adam Goldsworthy Oak survey drawing.
I'm still here, so just looking.
Sure.
Okay. Okay. Yes, I see a survey drawing from Adam and Goldsworthy.
Okay.
I don't do you recall the title, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's Exhibit A6, right? It says base map. It's kind of towards the bottom.
Right, it's sheet 1 of 1. Looks like it was prepared on February 8th or 6th, 2020. I can't really read it.
Yeah, that's the one. In any event, do you recall that you know survey drawing was submitted to the city in connection with the 44 unit condominium project and the payment for the building permit application fees?
I haven't looked at I've looked at the building permit application document itself, but I haven't looked at the plans related to these.
Okay, but you do recall the building permit applications?
The document, the application, the two-page application document, I have seen that. I haven't looked at the plans or anything else.
Okay. The site in question here, it's zoned residential under the HSR2 zoning district, correct?
No.
Is that a no?
That is a no. It's zoned okay. High School Road 1 or 2. I don't recall. I believe it's High School Road 2.
You believe High School Road 2 what?
That's the zoning.
Okay, and then residential is a permitted use in that zoning.
That's correct.
Okay, that's all I was getting at. all right. And you're familiar with the Bamer John Municipal Code based on your 17 years working at the city, I assume.
Yes.
Okay, and you're familiar with the exemption from site plan and design review for single family residential development?
Yes.
And it's correct, isn't it, that under the Bainbridge Island Municipal Code that the term use, quote unquote use, encompasses residential, correct?
The term use could apply to residential, yes.
Okay. And you're familiar with the city code provision that provides that condominium developments are not subject to the subdivision section of the code, correct?
No, I'm not familiar with that, or perhaps you can.
Sure, yeah, it's BIMC 17.08.020.E as an echo dot one.
Mr. Examiner, if I may interpose at this point, I'm not sure of the relevance of the subdivision code to this and whether it's exempt. I believe that that was one of the issues that is no longer part of this hearing, if I'm not mistaken. Whether or not the subdivision proposal would apply, or subdivision regulations would apply to the condominium proposal.
Mr. Gordy, I guess, what is the point you're ultimately hoping to make here?
Sure. What I'm getting at is it's relevant to this matter what my client could do in the absence of a site plan, because as the city points out in its brief, it calls it a serious rebuttal that the point we make, we could proceed straight to building permit applications under this condo proposal in the absence of a site plan. So I think that's relevant for you to bear in mind when you're analyzing in particular section 49 under the hearing examiner's decision. So it's important to know what the hearing examiner was balancing in sure. his mind.
So you're reiterating the argument made in your appellant's brief. I just am not sure what function Ms. Tyara has in that respect.
Okay,
I just trying to get her to agree with your legal logic. Is that what's going on?
Well, I just want to make sure that the city's not going to disagree with how we view the code.
Well, I know they disagree with how you view the code, but
well, that the particular
more specific.
Well, I think I was in that last question about for a condominium development, the subdivision section of the code is not applicable. That was my question. I just want to make sure that there's not a dispute over that. And apparently Ms. Tyara doesn't have that, you know, off the cuff.
Sure.
So I'm willing to move on if
she's. Yeah, I think we can move on.
All right. Ms. Tyara, you were obviously employed by the city when this Visconti proposal was moving through the process, correct?
That's right.
And what was your role, if any, in that process?
I had no role in the process. I would field questions from the public every once in a while at the counter as part of my normal duties.
Okay. Do you recall that there was considerable community opposition to the project?
I do. Well, I mean, yes, I do.
Okay. Okay. Did you attend the Visconti proceedings in 2014?
No.
Okay. Do you agree with Mr. Smith in his testimony that there's a shortage of affordable housing on Bainbridge Island?
Yes.
And how many affordable housing projects are there currently on Bainbridge Island in the downtown High School Road area?
If you're asking about how many projects there are that incorporate affordable housing?
Yes, currently under construction, if you know.
I do not know for certain.
Okay, and you estimate?
I would estimate it at less than a dozen.
In the downtown high school area, less than a dozen?
The downtown and the high school areas are two different things. I'm not sure if you're referring to the zoning or...
Well, let's limit it to the high school area.
I'm not aware of any affordable housing projects in the high school road districts. That doesn't mean they don't exist. I'm just not aware of any.
Okay, thank you. That's all I have, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rogers, did you have any questions for this witness in terms of cross?
I do not, thank you.
Okay, any redirect, Mr. Haney?
No, Mr. Examiner.
Thank you, Ms. Tyra.
Thank you.
We'll call Heather Wright.
Okay, if we can unmute Ms. Wright. Director Wright, are you there? You might need to unmute yourself.
I've given her permissions to unmute. There she goes. Okay.
Sorry about the delay.
No problem. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly clear.
Okay. It's a little quiet on our end, at least on my end.
Is that any better?
That's a little bit better.
Okay.
Okay. If we can't hear you, I'm just going to stop everybody and, you know, be rude like I often am. So I'm going to get you sworn in. Do you swear affirm to tell the truth in any testimony you give here today?
I do.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Wright.
Good morning, Mr. Haney.
Ms. Wright, can you please give your full name and spell your last name for the record?
My name is Heather Jean Wright, spelled W-R-I-G-H-T.
And what is your current position at the City of Bainbridge Island?
I'm the Director of Planning and Community Development.
And how long have you been with the City of Bainbridge Island?
For 13 years.
Can you tell us what other positions you've held at the city since you joined the city employment?
Yes, I joined the city in 2007 as an associate planner until 2015. And then I served as a senior planner for 2 years. And then I moved into a planning management position for 3 years before I became the planning director last year.
And what prior planning experience did you have before joining the City of Bainbridge Island?
Before joining the city, I served as a planner for the Florida Keys for 3.5 years.
And can you tell us, summarize for us your education?
Yes, I have a Bachelor of Science in Geography and a Master's in Urban Planning.
What is your role in, what was your role in the Central Highlands interpretation that's at issue in this case?
My role included discussions with staff about their proposal, and my role also included an avenue for the applicants to determine the appropriate scope of the project by applying for an administrative interpretation. The applicant had met with myself and I believe Ms. Tayara to discuss the proposal. And when it became clear that there was some disagreement on how to proceed, it was recommended that the applicant proceed with an administrative interpretation. And lastly, I reviewed that interpretation and signed that interpretation.
Did you also review documents relating to the Visconti property and the Visconti site plan in determining what the interpretation should be?
I did.
Specifically, did you review the hearing examiner's decision on the Visconti master plan or site plan?
I did.
Did you also review the hearing examiner's reconsideration orders on that site plan?
I did.
Did you review the site plans themselves that were approved as part of the Visconti site plan approval?
I did.
And did you also look at the traffic study that Ms. Tayara talked about?
I have looked at the traffic study. I did not look at it for the decision, but I have looked at it since the decision.
So let me begin with the decision itself. What is your understanding of what the hearing examiner approved in 2014 for the Visconti site plan and conditional use permit?
He approved a commercial project, exclusively commercial project, on 8 acres comprised of 7 buildings. Some of the uses that were anticipated to occur included medical use, as well as pharmacy, retail, and restaurant, and lastly, a drive-through bank.
Did the decision have, or did the project that was approved have any residential component according to the hearing examiner's decision?
No.
Did the site plans that were submitted or that were approved by the hearing examiner have any residential component?
No.
Is it your understanding that the traffic study that was done contained any analysis of residential traffic impacts?
It did not.
And did you also look at the project narrative for the Visconti site plan approval?
I did.
And did it include any residential component?
It did not.
Ms. Wright, did you also review the Wintergreen Apartments proposal, the request for interpretation that contained 100 to 140 residential units?
I did.
And in your opinion, Ms. Wright, is that proposal consistent with the Visconti decision, site plan, traffic study, the other documents you testified to?
It is not.
And why is that?
It is a different use altogether. Commercial and residential uses are looked at differently in our code in multiple ways, including the way that our comprehensive plan views those two uses. There are also, if there are two different uses proposed on a lot, the floor area ratio calculation is also different. The SEPA, the site plan review criteria, landscaping, the list goes on. The analysis is very different for those two different uses.
And in your review of the documents relating to the Visconti site plan approval, was any of that analysis done relating to residential uses or apartment uses on the Visconti site?
It was not.
Now, we also heard testimony from Mr. Smith today about a condominium proposal of 44 condominiums on separate lots. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do.
In your opinion, Ms. Wright, is the construction of 44 residential buildings on these lots that are subject to this interpretation, is that consistent with the Visconti site plan that was approved?
It is not.
And why is that?
Again, the use that was approved was commercial. The use that was approved was limited to two buildings, and what is proposed is a change in use and also a change in building from two separate buildings to 40 to 44 individual buildings.
Ms. Wright, do you have an opinion as to whether or not an amendment of the site plan would be necessary in order to allow the apartment development or the condominium development?
Yes, I do.
And what is that opinion?
The code specifically lays out what happens once a site plan is approved and there are adjustments that are proposed to that site plan. And our code states there are two ways to pursue that adjustment. You can either pursue what is called a minor adjustment, and then if anything is not a minor adjustment, then a new or amended application is necessary as determined by the director.
Ms. Wright, if I could interrupt you.
Yes.
Mr. Gorey asked questions of Ms. Tyara about the fact that residential development is exempt from site plan review. Is that correct? And how does that apply to the Wintergreen apartments and the condominium proposal?
The code does give an example of a minor site plan review to include more than four units. And so the code does indicate that if you are doing less than four units, you may be exempt from site plan review. However, this project has an approved site plan review for those particular lots for a commercial use. And at a minimum, that site plan review would need to be adjusted to reflect that those uses were not proceeding. And then a secondary question would be if the new proposal would require a site plan review or not. And so there is a potential that there could be both an adjustment to the existing site plan and a new site plan that's required for the new proposal.
And you mentioned, Ms. Wright, major site plan and minor site plan adjustments. Can you tell us the difference between the two?
Yes. Minor adjustments, as the code states, include a minor change in the dimensions or the siting of a structure or the location of a public amenity, but do not include a change to the intensity or the character of use. So if I could reflect on those, what we are looking at in the proposal, both of these proposals, include a change in the dimension and the siting of a structure. And we are looking at a change in the character of the use. The intensity is not clear. That would largely depend on the traffic study, but I want to iterate that these are ors and not ands. Lastly, I want to reiterate that a minor adjustment is processed through a written request from the applicant and a written response from the staff. And that response is placed in the file and it's effective immediately to modify the approval. I think that's important to note. There is no public process in this application. It is a note to file. I've processed many of these for other applications. To give an example of what we've applied this to, we've applied a 44-unit residential development that had four different unit types. And based on the demand for certain unit types, the proposal morphed to include more of some unit types and less than others. And that was not a change in use, nor was it a change in intensity, but it was a minor change in the siting of a structure and was therefore a minor adjustment. And the last point I want to make about minor adjustments is the fee for a minor adjustment is only $900. If I could compare that to what our code says, if you are not a minor adjustment, then you are either required to have a new or an amended application as determined by the director. And then it further goes to state that a major adjustment includes changes to the basic design, intensity, density, or the character of the use. Again, these are ors. And as I see it, this proposal at a minimum changes the design, potentially the intensity, it changes the density, and it changes the character of use.
So Ms. Wright, based on your conclusions regarding that, is this a major site plan amendment or a minor site plan amendment?
It is a major site plan amendment.
What is the process, Ms. Wright, for processing a major site plan amendment under the code?
We would require the same process that we would require for a new application. And what that would be a pre-application meeting with review by our design review board and a public participation meeting, which would require notice to the surrounding properties so they could have an opportunity for early input. And then the project would be formally submitted, and that would require again a second review by our design review board, a recommendation by our planning commission, a decision by our planning director, myself, and then an opportunity for an appeal. And I want to iterate, there's also a public notice required for a new or an amended application, and that is not required for a minor adjustment.
Now, Ms. Wright, one of the things you said was that planning commission review was part of this process, and I believe that is one of the issues that has been raised by the applicant in this appeal. Is planning commission review required?
It is required.
Now, Ms. Wright, have you read condition 49 of the Visconti hearing examiner's decision?
Yes, I have.
And can you describe for us what you believe condition 49 says?
Yes, I can. The hearing examiner is emphasizing a change in use approval being required before any building use is converted. And it talks about the conversion from a medical to retail is prohibited. And then lastly, it reflects on the ITE trip generation rate. Speaking to, if it's higher than 5 trips per 1,000 square feet, it shall require a new conditional use. So my read of this indicates that the hearing examiner contemplated that there would be a variety of commercial uses, because there are a variety of commercial uses that could potentially be placed in those buildings. A traffic study that was performed on this project contemplated pharmacy, retail, restaurant, and drive-through banks. Different commercial retail uses generate different types of traffic. I want to further note that the traffic analysis indicated that the site had a level of service D, and that level of service was not anticipated to change with this project. My understanding of this condition was that change in use could potentially generate more traffic, and we may need to look at those uses to ensure that the level of service standards were not pushed into failure with any change in commercial use.
Ms. Wright, is there anything in that condition, and I believe you're referring to condition 49A, is there anything in that condition which, in your opinion, allows approval of a conversion from commercial to residential use?
No. And I will say that is not just limited to that condition. It's looking at the full findings of facts and conclusions in the hearing examiner's decision that also helped me to support that decision. That is clearly limited to commercial.
Does that condition also refer to the conversion of uses in a building?
Yes.
And is there anything in that condition which allows a building to be split in multiple structures?
No.
And approval to be allowed?
No.
How do you interpret that condition with respect to that prospect?
This condition is limited to a building use being converted, not the building itself being converted or changed in its exterior dimensions. Those are, I don't believe this condition was intended to address that.
Ms. Wright, did you, excuse me, is there anything in this condition which addresses that these decisions allowed under 49A are totally administrative in nature? Let me rephrase my question. I think I phrased that pretty confusingly. I even confused myself.
So you always catch yourself when you do that, Mr. Haney. I appreciate that about you. Let me rephrase.
Thank you, Mr. Examiner. Thank you, Mr. Examiner. Ms. Wright, the condition 49A talks about the city's approval of a conversion. Can you tell us how you read the process for getting that approval?
Yes, I can tell you how I read this. What I would read this as is when the applicant came in for their building permit, and the permit, in the way that I've seen site plan reviews, move through the process after the hearing examiner's decision, a building permit would come in that matched the square footage and design of the building that was approved by the examiner. And at the time of permit, the applicant would indicate the use that was proposed for that building. And we would compare that use to the potential uses that were approved on the site plan. And then we would have our development engineer, who is a normal review of a building permit, determine the trips that would be generated by that use. And as the hearing examiner indicated, if it was found that it was greater than 5 trips per 1,000 square feet, then a new conditional use permit would be required.
Is there anything in condition 49A, in your opinion, which is inconsistent with requiring a site plan amendment under the circumstances presented by this case?
No.
Is there anything in that condition which you believe allows you to bypass the site plan amendment provisions in the city code and approve this amendment administratively?
Absolutely not. Nor has it is it anything that I have administered or witnessed in my 13 years of serving the city of Bainbridge Island.
And with respect to condition 49B, what do you believe that condition relates to?
49B relates to the project being reviewed by the design review board. That is an integral part of the site plan review process. And oftentimes, once a project is approved, there are changes to the exterior of the building footprint. And oftentimes, projects aren't fully, the exterior isn't fully developed. If I could rewind for a moment, when we approve a site plan review, we approve the footprint of a building, we approve the elements of an exterior, but those exteriors change. And this was to allow the staff to determine that depending on how much the exterior of the building changed, with the assumption that the footprint was staying the same, staff would have the opportunity to take the application to the design review board for input. This happens often during the building permit phase. Once a project is approved by the hearing examiner, once the building permit actually comes in, if there is enough change to design elements, it is then taken back to the design review board for further comment. And that's how I understand this condition.
Is there anything in that condition, in your opinion, that authorizes or that relates to the conversion of commercial uses to residential uses under this site plan?
No.
I'd like to ask you some questions about floor area ratio, if I can, since yes, that is an issue here. Can you explain to us how floor area ratio, or FAR, is calculated under the Bainbridge Island Municipal Code?
Yes, I can. Let me pull up just one moment a table. that was referenced in your briefing. Each zoning district has allocated to it a floor area ratio for a commercial use and a floor area ratio for a residential use. And it also includes a mixed use floor area ratio. And the way that it is calculated is you take the size of the lot, and we can just do simple math here. If you had a 10,000 square foot lot and they're proposing commercial, you use table 1812-020-3, and you start with the basic FAR, the base FAR. So if you're proposing commercial, the FAR is 0.3. So under that scenario, there would be an allowance for 3,000 square feet of commercial. And that could be a 1,500 square foot footprint with a 1,500 second story, or it could be a 3,000 square foot footprint building, for example. If someone is proposing strictly residential under this scenario, again, with a 10,000 square foot lot, you would also multiply that by 0.3. So in the high school 1 and 2 zoning districts, the FAR for commercial and residential are set at 0.3. And under that scenario, the same would be true, that they would be allowed 3,000 square feet of residential. However, there's also a mixed use standard, which is 0.3. So under that scenario, with a footnote of number 2, at the bottom of the table, and I will read footnote number 2, in mixed use developments, the established FAR and the residential component shall not be exceeded. So what that means is if you're proposing a mixed use development, the maximum FAR you can have is 0.3, which is the 3,000 square feet again. And of that, the commercial can't exceed 0.3, nor can the residential exceed 0.3. Which that might sound a little odd, but it makes more sense in some of the other zoning districts as to why it's described that way. And so what that would mean is that a mixed use development is limited to 0.3, meaning that the commercial cannot exceed 0.3. So you could potentially have 1,000 square feet of commercial and you could have 2,000 square feet of residential, but the collective FAR cannot exceed 0.3.
Now, Mr. Smith testified, I believe, and I'll try not to mischaracterize his testimony. Mr. Smith testified that these figures were cumulative, that you could accumulate 0.3 plus 0.3 plus 0.3 and arrive at 0.9, 90% development on a site. Mm-hmm. Is that your understanding of how FAR is calculated under the Bainbridge Island Municipal Code?
Absolutely not. I've never heard that before, nor have I had anyone propose that before.
So I think you said that the total was 0.3 no matter what, and it was a cumulative 0.3 as opposed to 8.9. Is that correct?
That's correct. With one caveat, we're just talking about the base FAR. Under these scenarios, there is the ability to increase under bonus, which I'm just
going to
say that.
Okay. Now, Ms. Wright, is there is FAR calculated on a development-wide basis on a property such as the Visconti site, or is it calculated on a lot-by-lot basis?
It is calculated on a lot-by-lot basis. For the Visconti proposal, I wanted to reference an exhibit that was provided by the applicant. Give me a moment to.
I believe that would be exhibit A7, is that correct? Or
I'm sorry, when I say the applicant, I meant one of our exhibits.
One of ours, okay.
Yes, just a moment, please. It included the project description and the project proposal, and it provided the FAR for each individual lot, showing that none of the lots exceeded It's exhibit C5, if I could draw our attention to the bottom of page C5. Under the proposed lots, each lot had an individual FAR calculation showing that none of the lots exceeded the 0.3 FAR available for commercial.
This is the last page of exhibit C5?
That's correct.
The letter from Wenslow Architects, correct? From
That's correct.
Okay, just making sure.
And in preparation of this hearing, as I understand, there have been some boundary line adjustments performed on some of these lots. As developed, none of the lots exceed the 0.3 FAR.
Now, you mentioned bonus density, Ms. Wright. How does bonus density work under the, or bonus FAR, I'm sorry. How does bonus FAR work under the Bainbridge Island Municipal Code?
Bonus FAR allows you to increase your FAR, but it's an exchange for some type of community benefit. For example, you can increase your FAR, but you have to do something in order to earn that bonus. And I could refer back to the table. I can just briefly describe what's available in the high school road district, for example. With a bonus, the commercial could be at 0.6. The same is true for residential at 0.6. And the mixed use maximum is 1.0. And just like under the earlier scenario, that means that the residential cannot exceed 0.6, nor can the commercial exceed 0.6. So for example, you can have a 0.5 commercial and a 0.5 residential to have a total of a 1.0 mixed use under the bonus scenario.
Is there a way to transfer density from one parcel or one lot within the city to another under that bonus density provision?
There was, but that provision is no longer available due to the passage of Ordinance 2020-10, which occurred on March 10th of 2020.
March 10th of, I'm sorry, can you mention
2020. I can read from that if it's helpful.
Well, let me ask the question of, is under the, Mr. Smith testified about transferring density from the Islander Mobile Home Park to one of his projects. Was that available under that bonus density program?
It was available, and it's still, I want to clarify, there is a provision to transfer density from the Islander Mobile Home Park in our bonus FAR program, but it is available only in the mixed-use town center, meaning you can transfer FAR from the mobile home park to another property in the mixed-use town center, but that does not include the high school road district properties.
What about the transfer of FAR from other lots within the Visconti site plan to the Central Highlands proposed site?
I will read to you what is no longer available, but it was anticipated and underneath the bonus program. If you would like me to read that out loud, I may, but it is no longer available under this interim development ordinance.
Okay. And
under there, I will just for the record say this was previous 1812-030E5. And it says the Winslow Town Center mixed use / high school road FAR transfers. And it goes to say up to 20% of the maximum residential, commercial, or mixed use FAR bonus may come from transfers of FAR parcels within the mixed use town center and the high school road districts. The transfer shall create permanent open space through open space preservation covenants on sending parcels that contain critical areas as defined in chapter 1620. And then it goes on further to give an example of that.
So how would you interpret that provision as it would relate to this property?
If you were to have a property, for example, that had a critical area on it, meaning it had a wetland, stream, or steep slope, and it was located in the Winslow Town Center, Mixed Use Town Center, or High School Road District. And let's say, for example, you had an acre of land and you chose to preserve that into permanent open space. You could take the FAR, for example, if it was 1 acre and the residential FAR available was 1 acre times 0.3, and I'll just say that's 15,000 square feet for simplicity's sake, then you could transfer up to 20% of that 15,000 to a property in the Mixed Use Town Center or the High School Road District.
Now, does that description that you're giving of properties with wetlands or critical areas that can transfer density, does that apply to any of these lots within the Visconti site plan?
I understand, and I've done a site visit, that there is at least portions of a wetland buffer on the most easterly lot, one of the more easterly lots. So there is a potential that transfer could have occurred under this provision. The exact amount, I do not know. The calculation I have not performed.
But just generally under the city's regulations as they existed prior to this provision or prior to this moratorium, not moratorium, but interim regulation, could one have transferred unused residential FAR from Visconti lots to the lots that Central Highlands?
Yes.
One could have.
Under this number 5, correct.
And it wouldn't take but would that only be for sites with wetlands on them, or would that just be generally?
The sender site would have to have a critical area on it. The receiving site would not.
Are you aware of any request by any of the lot owners within the Visconti property other than Central Highlands to move the FAR from their lots to the Central Highland lots?
No.
So Central Highlands' contention appears to be that there is some sort of unused residential FAR that is floating around over this site that can be transferred to their property in order to give them the FAR they need. Do you agree with that or disagree with that?
I disagree with that.
And why is that?
The floor-area ratio is calculated by the lot, is dependent on the lot area itself. Each of those lots may have some potential residential available to them, but that residential cannot be shifted amongst the lots because the ability to do that is limited to one section of the code, and that section of the code is no longer available. However, I will say the caveat, if all of the lots were aggregated into one lot, then that scenario of the floating above would be treated the same way as if we treat each individual lot as far as the calculation of FAR. But as it is today, these two lots are subject to the calculation that is based on the lot area of the lots that are seeking to develop.
Okay, so Ms. Wright, you reviewed the interpretation that was drafted by Ms. Tayara?
Yes, I did.
And Did you concur with that interpretation?
Yes, I did.
Did you make any significant changes in Ms. Tayara's draft interpretation?
I did not.
And after hearing the testimony today, is there any thing you would do differently in terms of that interpretation?
No, I would not.
Is there anything else that you believe that the hearing examiner should know in these proceedings in order to make the interpretation, or in order to consider whether your interpretation was correct?
I would like to direct the hearing examiner to the hearing examiner's decision, which is our exhibit C, one moment, C1. I can direct the examiner just when he is writing his report to page 34 in particular. I'm going to read in just a moment when I get there. I'm sorry, I do not have paper copies, so I'm scrolling. So give me a moment. Number 13 is specific to the comp plan language that was referenced, and it specifically states that the general land use policy 1.4, quote, new commercial centers shall be considered only after a detailed analysis of the economic impact of a new development shows there will be no significant adverse impact on existing commercial centers, including Winslow. And then it goes on further to talk about the Visconti site if it's a new commercial center. And I bring that up just to reiterate that the review of this project in terms of the comprehensive plan was very specific to the commercial nature of this project. And I also want to direct the Mr. Examiner to page 36, which is the start of the site plan review analysis and the criteria that this proposal was subject to, which is also very specific to a commercial project. And in closing, I would like to express to Mr. Examiner and to the applicant that there is a path forward for them, that the code does allow residential to be developed. I don't think the dispute here is if residential is allowed. Residential is an allowed use. But this project was not reviewed as a residential project. And there was a high level of public involvement and interest in this project, as Ms. Tayara stated. I believe that she was the one that was asked, or it may have been Mr. Smith. There was a high level of interest and involvement in this project, and all of the analysis that was done was for a commercial use. And I am very sure that the project, any revision to this project to the commercial use as proposed, would need to go through the public process that would involve a review by our planning commission, our design review board, and have opportunities for public input and review. And that is all I have to say.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. I have no further questions for you.
Thank you. Before I hand this off, I have one specific question I wanted to ask before I forget, and the attorneys hate when I do this, but I do sometimes ask questions. And my question is procedural in nature. The appellant, whatever we're calling them, has made an interpretation, or they think that the former hearing examiner in condition 49A meant something in particular. And my read of it is that you do not agree, if that is correct, that, well, Mr. Haney, you got in my head and now I can't phrase my question how I had wanted to. Let me try this again. So the appellant has essentially said they think that under condition 49A, Mr. Smith, the former hearing examiner, was sort of allowing for the potential of a different procedure. I think that's an accurate statement. I'm getting nods from Mr. Gorey. My question procedurally for you, Ms. Wright, is A, did the hearing examiner have the authority to change the requirements of the municipal code as part of his decision? And B, if he didn't, am I bound by this former decision of the hearing examiner, even if it's legally incorrect?
My understanding is no, the hearing examiner does not have the right to change the process in our code. And B, do you have the right to overturn the decision of the hearing examiner? I would say you do not have that right, that the right would happen through an appeal of the examiner's decision. I would also want to state again that our code outlines the process for adjustments to a site plan, and that condition still prevails. For example, many site plans I have seen do not go into the what ifs, right? What's the what ifs of you're going to change the site plan and therefore you're bound to this process. That is not customarily included in the decision on a project. So I would state that this section of the code, while it wasn't referenced, it would still apply to this project because the examiner was not making a decision on an adjustment to a site plan. He was making a decision on the site plan that was before him. And so this section would not have needed to be contemplated, and that condition is limited to commercial uses.
Sure, and just so I follow, part A, you said the hearing examiner didn't have the authority to change the code. I got lost on part B. So even if that interpretation is, the appellant is correct in thinking that the hearing examiner did this thing where he sort of changed the allowable process under the code.
Mm-hmm.
Part B, I have to follow that. Is that what your next part was? I was confused by that.
Yes, I apologize for that. And maybe this would be something for Mr. Haney to weigh in on. My professional opinion is yes, you would have to follow what the examiner stated.
Okay.
Great. Again, Mr. Examiner, from our perspective, that's not what the condition says.
I fully understand. Right.
Condition fully says city approval. It doesn't specify what the city's approval process will be. It says that the changes in use require city approval, and our position is that is consistent with the city's approval process that's in the code.
Sure, I fully understand. I just was clarifying that if I happen to, disagree with a different, earlier decision made by a different hearing examiner, whether I'm bound to it, and Ms. Wright said she thinks I am. So,
I would also indicate that that's a legal conclusion, Mr. Examiner. So,
it is a legal conclusion, and I don't know if I necessarily agree with it, but that's okay. I was getting her interpretation. So, those were my questions. Thank you, Ms. Wright. I'm going to turn you over to Mr. Gorey at this point for cross examination.
Mr. Examiner, I don't know what the other participants are thinking, but it's 12:20 now, and my stomach is rumbling. I think we've got fair amount of time left. We got closing arguments and cross examination here, and I don't know if this is an opportune time to break for lunch.
You want a break before we're done with Ms. Wright?
Mr. Examiner, I guess my thought is that I don't know how much cross examination Mr. Gorey has, but it would seem to me that Ms. Wright is our only witness. I don't know if Mr. Gorey plans on calling a rebuttal witness or whether we're just into closing argument. It doesn't seem to me like we have that much to go, and I'd probably rather just get it done from my perspective. But
from my perspective, other than maybe a 5-minute break, if people are 10-minute break to use the facilities, I would rather charge through, because I think we are near the end of witnesses. And as some folks know, I personally prefer closing arguments in written form, but I'll let people argue them orally if they prefer that. But I think that either way, we're far enough along. I would, rather than take a long break, I would propose maybe 10 minutes, come back, cross-examination, and then we can talk about closing.
That sounds great.
So enough time for a snack and a bathroom break. So it's 12:22. Why don't we say 12:35? We'll shoot to be back here.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
All right. We are recording.
Thank you. So we're just coming back on the record after a short recess. And when we concluded, we were about to move over to cross-examination of Heather Wright. And I'll start with Mr. Gorey. So please proceed, Mr. Gorey.
Thank you. Let's see. It's afternoon. Good afternoon, Ms. Wright.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gorey.
So you agree with Kelly Tyara that the subject lots are zoned for residential, correct?
The subject lots can have both commercial and residential uses, yes.
Okay, and you would also agree with Ms. Tyara that under Bainbridge City Code, the term use encompasses residential. That is one of the numerous uses, correct?
Correct, residential is a use.
Okay. I don't, maybe I missed this when you were testifying. Did you attend the Visconti proceedings back in 2014?
I have a memory of at least looking in the room, but I don't think I actually sat in the hearing.
All right. And what was your position with the city at that time?
I was an associate planner at the time.
Okay. Did you yourself do any work on the Visconti project?
I did not.
So with respect to condition 49 on page 58 of the hearing examiner decision, the one we've been talking about, it's correct, isn't it, that that was a condition that was created by the hearing examiner separate apart from any recommendation from city staff?
From what I can tell, yes. And that's based on a review of the staff report, that seemed to come from the examiner.
Okay. And, you know, in fact, if you recall in the hearing examiner decision, the hearing examiner, Stafford Smith, you know, previews that and says, hey, I've added some new conditions, and if anyone's not happy with anything, please move for reconsideration. Have you seen that portion?
Yes.
Okay. And that's the section 49. The city did not move for reconsideration, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And the city did not appeal the decision, correct?
That's correct.
Now, as to condition 49, you personally have not spoken with Stafford Smith regarding this section, have you?
I have not.
Okay, so like all of us, you're left with the words in the order, correct?
That's correct.
All right, and then, so change of use in section 49A, you see that?
I do.
Okay, and so the, as you've testified, the permitted uses under the site plan are commercial and retail, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and so if there's to be a change of use, wouldn't it stand to reason that that would be to some use other than commercial and retail?
I want to specify the commercial uses for pharmacy, retail, restaurant, and the drive-through bank, as well as the medical uses.
Okay, but there are other uses that are the property is zoned for besides commercial and retail, correct?
That's correct.
All right. So if you know, in a standard kind of typical reading, based on your experience, change of use, you know, residential would be included under the rubric of use, correct?
Yes, that's correct. if I was reading that in isolation, a change of use from commercial to residential is a change of use.
Okay. All right. I'd like to move on to floor area ratio.
Okay.
So we were talking about the table under the Bainbridge Island Code. Let me call it up here. So it's table 18.12.020-3.
That's correct.
Do you have that in front of you by chance?
I do.
Okay, and you testified about that, and one of the things you were talking about is, you know, whether floor area ratio is, you know, cumulative or not, and one of the things I wanted to circle back to is under the maximum with bonus section.
Yes.
Right, you see mixed use.
Yes.
Under the HSR 1 and 2 column.
Yes.
So that's 1.0, which means 100% of the square footage, right, can be used for mixed use with the bonus.
Yes.
I think the example you gave was that, you know, hypothetically, it could be, you know, 50% residential, 50% commercial.
Yes.
Okay, so when we're talking about the bonus, at least, then it is additive in the sense that you can use some of one, some of the other, and it adds up to more than just the 0.6 for each.
That's correct. It does under the bonus section.
Okay, but your testimony is that's not true under the baseline FAR?
It is not true for the high school district. That is correct.
Okay. Now, I believe you also testified as to FAR that, you know, for a project, you know, where lots are aggregated, let's say a plat, you would look at the entire square footage, the entire project, and that would be, you know, deemed the lot for purposes of FAR. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So when you're talking about a plat, as opposed to a site plan, plat is works its way through the process, and then at some point lot lines are drawn. Okay, and you're aware that, you know, in practice on Bainbridge Island, that the developers allocate FAR, you know, in plats as between the lots, right? You're aware of that?
Yes.
Okay, David, Mr. Smith testified to that, for instance, at Madison Place. You're aware of how he's allocating FAR there, I assume.
Loosely, but I understand the concept. I have done subdivisions and I have performed them that way.
Okay. There's nothing in the code that prohibits that kind of allocation with a plat, correct?
Actually, that nothing prohibits it. The code allows it specifically for subdivisions.
Okay, great. But then with respect to a site plan, you know, is it your testimony that that's different than a plat for allocation of FAR, simply because, you know, in a given site plan, maybe the lots are pre-existing as opposed to developed at some point during the project process?
That's correct.
Okay, where in the code does it draw that distinction between site plan and plat in terms of allocation of FAR, in terms of when the lot lines are drawn or whether they pre-exist?
It's defined under the definition of floor area, which is in 1812. One moment. Under 1812.050 rules of measurement, where it defines how you calculate floor area. And then the subdivision chapter, I can't reference the exact section for you, but the subdivision chapter, we calculate it based on, we allow it to float above and then land down as we create new lots. It used to be called our flex lot standard, which allowed us to have, for example, if we were doing dwelling units per acre, it allowed you to calculate the lot area based on all of the lots being proposed to be subdivided, and then you would land that on the individual parcels. That was a different process for subdivisions. But I'm not answering which section it is. I don't know off the top of my head for subdivisions where it is.
Okay, all right, thank you. I'm looking at BIMC 1812050G, which is defines floor area ratio.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'll just read it in the event that not everyone is there. So floor area ratio, in quotes, is a figure that expresses the total floor area as a multiple of the lot area. This figure is determined by dividing the floor area of all buildings on a lot by the lot area prior to removal of lot area for dedication. Portions of parking located underneath the building footprint are not counted in floor area ratio calculations. Okay, did I read that correctly? Are you looking at it?
Yes, I am, and yes, you did.
Okay, so I guess the question that I'm trying to get at is, when you're talking about a site plan, as we are here, where there were existing lots, yet the existing lots are aggregated for purposes of the site plan, how does the section I just read or anything else in the code differentiate it from a plat where the developer can allocate, you know, amongst the lots?
A plat is creating new lots. This project did not create any lots.
Okay, that's the differentiator in your opinion?
And there is a process to aggregate your lots. And this application was not required to aggregate their lots, nor did they.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that last bit.
This application was not required to aggregate their lots, nor did they aggregate their lots. You spoke to aggregation. That is a process that's recognized in our code.
And that's recognized in the context of a site plan?
No, it's a separate land use process to aggregate your lots.
Okay, but that's not required for a site plan to aggregate.
It may be a condition. I have seen projects that have been required to aggregate their lots to meet the requirements of our municipal code. And there is a process for that, but this project is not subject nor required to aggregate.
Okay, so where in the code does it say that for a site plan where the lots are not required to be aggregated, that FAR is allocated on the component lots as opposed to the entire area of the site plan?
In converse, I would ask you the same question. Where does it say that you count it that way? When you look at the definition of floor area, it's based on lot area, not based on the aggregate lot area. And when you go to the review criteria for a site plan and design review, one of the criteria is that it's in compliance with all sections of the code.
Okay. Forgive me, I'm reading here. Well, I'm looking at 1812050J lot area. And let me just read it for those who aren't there. So lot area, in quotes, means the total horizontal area within the lot lines, plural, excluding any area seaward of the line of the ordinary high watermark and excluding private streets in the lot area and panhandles of flag lots narrower than 30 feet. Did I read that correctly?
Yes, you did.
Okay, so that talks about the horizontal area within the lot lines, plural. So doesn't that indicate that in a site plan with multiple lots, we need to look at all of the lot lines in terms of the lot area vis-a-vis the site plan?
I would not draw that conclusion.
Okay, that's your opinion and a reading of that?
That's correct.
Okay. All right, are you aware that in the Visconti site plan that there were some boundary line adjustments and that, you know, lot lines were moved and thereby new lots were created?
There were lot lines moved, but I am not aware of any new lots being created. That would be called a subdivision of the land. I don't believe that happened.
Okay, but fair point. But by virtue of the boundary line adjustments, lot lines are moved and therefore lots are modified at a minimum if we don't deem them newly created lots, correct?
That's correct.
All right, now does that make any difference in your mind in terms of allocating FAR if there are boundary line adjustments moving lot lines akin to a plat where lot lines are laid down?
Then the calculation of lot area would be dependent on the new lot lines at the time that the building permit application comes in.
Okay. All right. I had a question about, well, let me ask you this, the building moratorium that's referenced in the city's response to the administrative code interpretation. How long has that been in effect?
Just so I'm clear, are we talking about the one for major site plan reviews and conditional use permits in the mixed use town center excluding the core?
No, I'm talking about when was the building moratorium first instituted?
I'm sorry, I apologize. We have multiple moratoriums going on. I believe the one that you're referencing was in January of 2018.
Okay, well, you say there's multiple moratoriums. What are you referring to?
Well, there's a moratorium on self-service storage. There's an interim development ordinance that's limited the use of our bonus bar. I make sure we're talking about the same moratorium.
Okay. Okay, so there's multiple moratoria, if that's the plural. Right. Okay. All right. But the building moratorium, the one you referenced, that was instituted in January 2018, so that's been roughly 2.5 years now. That's still in place. It's been narrowed, but it's still in place, correct?
That's correct. Yes, January 2018.
Okay, and it's set to expire currently October of this year?
That is correct.
Could be renewed for another 6 months. We don't know.
That's correct.
It's been renewed multiple times. I think I tried to figure this out. I counted like 5 renewals. I don't know if that's correct. Do you know how many renewals?
That sounds correct, yes.
Okay. All right. And then you referenced, and it's been discussed, this ordinance, if I jotted it down correctly, 2020-10. March 20th, 2020, and that relates to revision of BIMC Chapter 1827?
Not 1827. Correct, and 1812. The primary section that's been revised is 1812.
Okay, but the gist of the ordinance was to make it harder for folks to buy and sell floor area ratio. Is that fair to say?
It prohibited the ability to purchase bonus bar from the city. That's correct.
Okay, and that was commonly done before that, right? People would buy far from the city, correct?
Yes.
Okay, but the Mobile Home Association that you referenced, they can still sell their far, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Have you read that 2004 contract between the Mobile Home Association and the city regarding the mobile home's ability to sell far?
I have not.
Okay, because you testified earlier that the Mobile Home Association's ability to sell far in terms of receiving properties is limited to the MUTC. Is that what you said?
Yes, that's correct. And that is based on the code, which is what I referenced.
Okay, but the city code cannot unilaterally breach the contract with the Mobile Home Association, can it?
I'm going to object.
Where are we going?
And yeah, we're way afield.
To the extent that I'm confused on a lot of levels. The moratorium was one of your 14 appeal issues that was then dropped, and now we're talking about it again. Now you're talking about a contract that is outside the scope of the record, and you're asking whether, the municipal code can violate contracts. I just don't get where we're headed right now. Help me out.
I appreciate that. Yeah, no, my apologies. Ms. Wright testified about the Mobile Home Association, and I just wanted to make the point. I was wondering if she had read the contract, number one, and she testified she hasn't. I have, and I respectfully disagree with the city's position, so I wanted to just make the point that I believe Mobile Home Association under that contract is allowed to sell to any third party, and it's not limited to properties in the MUTC. That's all I'm driving at to clarify.
Depend on testifying. Did you need to get sworn in? Are you just laying the foundation?
Yes, I'm laying a foundation.
A RUPA appeal beyond what I'm addressing, which is certainly going to annoy me. I'm let's stick to what the actual appeal issues everyone agreed on is, and you can set up your future fights with the city in another forum. Not anything I want to address right now.
Okay, fair enough. But I did want to, that ordinance 2020-10, was that enacted, was it motivated in whole or in part by this, by my client's plans for the Visconti project?
I have no idea, right. Mr. Corey.
Okay, I think that covers everything. Well, actually, one other question. I'm sorry. So you testified earlier, I believe, that under state law, city code, that on these lots that you could develop 4 single family residences per lot, and that would be exempt from SEPA, correct?
I did not say it was exempt from SEPA. I did not speak to SEPA.
But you said it was exempt in some fashion. What did you say?
I spoke to site plan review.
Okay, so it's 4 homes or less, single family, exempt from site plan review.
That's correct.
Okay. All right, let me just, setting aside this whole argument over change of use and what section 49 means, let's just say we get to residential, however we get there. Would you agree with my client that with his condo proposal for 44 single family resident units, that he would be able to be exempt from site plan and design review, subdivision code would not apply, there'd be no SEPA review, and the city's review would be limited to the building permit applications and all that's associated with that?
I'm going to object to that again. I think this is beyond the scope of the narrowed issues that we have in this appeal.
Well,
Your Honor, if I may.
Hold on. I understand the objection. I was incredibly baffled by footnote 5 in Mr. Gorey's brief. And I think he's speaking to footnote 5, which essentially says under his client and his interpretation of the code for the city, and then you combine that with the Condominium Act and maybe one other thing, you end up with a point where, quote, there is no land use review process for detached single family residence condominium units other than the process associated with obtaining a building permit. So the argument he seems to make is if you interpret the code a certain way, condos, you could have a million of them and all you need is a building permit. I would like to hear what Ms. Wright has to say about it. So.
Okay, thank you. I just want to state one thing I want to clarify. So for a minor site plan review, it's under 216.040 subsection C1. An example of a minor site plan review is a fourplex. So it has to be less than 4 to be exempt from site plan review. I just wanted to clarify that. I apologize if I said that that you could have up to 4, it needs to be less than 4. I'm going to specify that on the record. As far as Mr. Gorey's claim that if the land is condoed, I think what he's stating is that we would view each of those condoed properties as having a single family residence on them. I want to say that our code does not have a section dedicated to the condo of land. I want to state that our code defines what single family is and what multifamily is. And if I could, I will read that and draw attention to that. That is in our definition section of the code. It's in 1836. And if you give me a moment, I will pull that up and read that for the record. Okay, it is kind of hidden in there. So number 82 is the dwelling slash a comma single family. Single family means a structure containing one dwelling unit on one lot and having a permanent foundation, and includes factory built homes and manufactured homes. And then if I could draw your attention to definition 170, which is multifamily development. And multifamily means a building or portion of a building containing two or more dwelling units or more than one dwelling unit on one lot, including multiple living units on a single parcel, sharing kitchen facilities, not including accessory dwelling units. Multifamily development also includes a mobile home park. And based on my reading of the definitions for both single family and multifamily, when an applicant condominiumizes the land, we have seen this with other land use approvals, the city does not recognize the condo as creating new lots. We still recognize the property as having one lot. And if you look at the definition again of multifamily, if there are, as Mr. Borey described or Mr. Smith described, 22 detached homes on one lot, condoed or not, that would fall under our definition of multifamily development, and the project would be subject to site plan review.
Okay, but let me. Are you familiar? Are you familiar at all with the Washington Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act, RCW 64.90?
And I don't think we need to keep going down the rabbit hole. I just wanted her quick response to the notion that it'd be possible to construct, call it 44 or call it 44,000 condominiums with nothing more than building permits. Her answer was no. The rest appears to be moving toward asking her legal conclusions that you're attempting to draw.
Fair enough. No, I know. So that's really what I was after. Is there a dispute on that point? I didn't know the answer to that. I do now, apparently. Okay. I think those are all my questions. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Rogers, did you have any cross-examination?
Just one question. During Ms. Wright's testimony, you made a reference to a provision in the subdivision code that you could not find a site for regarding floor area. I was wondering if you were able to come up with that site at any point over the last hour or so.
Are you asking me this?
No, I'm asking Ms. Wright if she knows. So okay. I mean, if you know too, that'd be fantastic.
I was like, wait, I don't remember that. Okay.
Yes, probably Ms. Wright would be the.
That makes more sense.
If I could, we have a new subdivision code, and it would lie. It doesn't define floor area, more so that it talks about how the density is allocated when you're subdividing the lots. And I am not as familiar with our new subdivision code because I've been the director since it's been approved, and I haven't applied it in the way that I did our previous code. So I cannot quickly reference that section. I apologize.
Thank you. That's all.
That concluded it. And Mr. Haney, any redirect?
I do have a little bit of redirect, not much. Ms. Wright, I just wanted to explore this idea that you were asked about when you can allocate FAR. And it seems to me that your answer earlier, or it seems to me that there's kind of a temporal component to this. Would you agree with me that you can allocate FAR when you come in for your initial subdivision or site plan approval? At that point, you could allocate FAR throughout the site or throughout the subdivision. Would that be a correct statement?
Yes.
And how do you square that with your statement that you can't allocate FAR between lots? Is it dependent upon when the lots were created or actually exist? In other words, if I come in for a subdivision as Mr. Smith might have done, and I'm going to subdivide property, I can allocate FAR between the various lots in the subdivision, correct?
Yes, you can.
Once the final plat is recorded and the lot lines all exist, can I reallocate FAR at that point under the city's code?
No, you cannot.
And why is that? Just if you can give us an explanation.
That's recorded on the final plat. Each lot would, for example, there's different restrictions on each individual lot once it's created. And those lots may have restrictions in terms of lot coverage, setbacks, how many dwelling units they could have. So that would be done on the face of the plat, recorded with the plat.
And once the plat is recorded and the lot lines are established, you cannot change the FAR at that point?
No.
Ms. Wright, I wanted to direct you, do you have the hearing examiner's decision from the Visconti proposal?
I do.
I'd like to ask you to turn to page 51 if you can. I know you have to scroll.
Okay.
And I'd like to direct you to condition 14.
Okay.
Can you just read that condition for us?
Yes. An approved boundary line adjustment shall be recorded with the Kitsap County Auditor prior to the issuance of any building permits where buildings are proposed over property lines or existing lines preclude meeting lot coverage, floor area ratio, or other zoning regulations.
So is that an indication that the floor area ratio, when there were existing lot lines in the Visconti property, that floor area ratio was to be calculated on a per lot basis and boundary line adjustment needed to be done in order to reallocate FAR?
Absolutely. And I've seen this as a condition. I've placed this condition on projects before to allow the review to occur as if the boundary line adjustment or as if an aggregation has occurred. By the time of building permit, we cannot issue a building permit that is not in compliance with these regulations.
Okay, now Mr. Gorey asked you about the definition in 1812.050J of lot area, and he placed great emphasis on the word lot lines being plural. Doesn't every lot have more than one lot line?
Yes.
And can you explain that for me, why you think that's the case?
Well, typically lots are in at least have four sides. Some have three. And so there are lot lines that reflect the boundaries of the lot. And in particular, when we're talking about boundary line adjustments, those often involve just the movement of at least one lot line. And that is how you calculate the area, is the area within those lines.
So do you read that provision as referring to the lot lines associated with multiple lots or just the lot from which the lot area is to be calculated?
The lot from which the lot area is to be calculated.
Now, you were also asked about the fact that some residential development may be not subject to site plan review. But if I understood your testimony when I asked you on direct, you indicated that there was an existing approved site plan for the particular parcels that Central Highlands is proposing to develop, correct?
That's correct.
And I believe you also said that that existing site plan needs to be altered either by doing a site plan for something else or by wiping it out to, or by amending the overall site plan to
allow this site to be developed differently. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes, I do, and that is correct.
And can you just expound on that and explain it just to make sure we understand that?
Your Honor, I feel like this is beyond the scope of my cross. I don't think I delved into the site plan adjustment issue. And we've already covered it in a previous testimony.
I think if I understood correctly, the testimony which Mr. Gorey was trying to solicit was that for a condo project, there wouldn't need to be a site plan. And I'm just getting to our point, which is that you need to amend the existing site plan, either to remove these properties from that existing site plan and allow them to be developed under whatever process is allowed, or you need to amend them to actually do a site plan on this property. And that's my only point.
Thank you, Mr. Haney. And that is correct. I was speaking more generally about what requires a site plan review, to say that our code says it less than four, but that doesn't negate the adjustment section to the code that's required when a project does have an existing site plan. So thank you for clarifying.
So when you testified about adjusting the site plan, is it the overall Visconti site plan that you are adjusting in order to, or the site plan for these particular lots that exists already in order to allow this development?
Yes, that would be correct. It would be to adjust the overall site plan for this development, the Visconti development.
Okay, I have no further questions.
Okay. I think then that concludes the testimony of Ms. Wright. Thank you for being here. That then I believe concludes our witnesses. Is that accurate?
That is so from the city's perspective.
Okay. And from appellants.
Okay, so first I have a legal question I would like the attorneys to weigh in on for me, the hearing examiner. And the legal question I have is, there are, I think we're down to 1, 2, 3, 4, sort of 5 issues, but 3 of them were basically all kind of clumped together. So the way I just happen to have the city's brief and closer, so the first one has to do with whether a site plan adjustment, an adjustment is required to move forward with residential rather than commercial. The second one noted is if an adjustment is required, whether planning commission review is necessary. And then the third is this issue of FAR. My legal question is, if I ultimately were to decide that site plan review, if I were to decide that an adjustment is necessary, and decide whether the Planning Commission must get involved, do I have any business or reason to touch on the third issue? Meaning if I say, this is required, you know, you got to go through this public process, you got to go through the approval process and the Planning Commission gets involved. Is there any reason that I right now should weigh in on this issue of FAR? So just any thoughts? I'll start with you, Mr. Gorey.
That's an interesting question. I still think the issue is ripe. I mean, even if we have to go through some kind of a review process, be it Planning Commission, DRB, or what have you, because, you know, what if the Planning Commission comes down, you know, contrary to my client's position, that's going to be a live dispute still. And I think it'd be great to hear from you, the hearing examiner at this point, to resolve that issue. That can only facilitate whatever process, you know, follows here.
Okay, I get the argument. Mr. Haney, your thought?
Well, it is one of their appeal issues, so, and we did opine on it, so I guess it is a live issue before you. You know, the city is interested in knowing your take as well. Again, we believe the code is clear, so.
Okay, Ms. Rogers, any thought on that?
I do think it's an issue that's been presented to you and you should be rendering a decision.
Happy to do it. Okay, just thought I'd ask. So finally, on closing, I want to be clear, Ms. Rogers, when we started the morning, I had not received your brief. I have now received it and even had time to read it when we took our break. So I am aware that you did submit a brief. My apologies again that I did not realize that. But I have read the briefs and I'm very familiar with them. I don't believe that written argument, closing argument would be necessary, but does anyone prefer that method or would like to do that? Now would be your opportunity to request it.
Go ahead, Mr. Haney.
I was just going to say that I don't think it's necessary given that the primary issues before you are legal as opposed to factual. If we had had a lot of testimony here today about factual issues, then I think it might be appropriate to do a closing argument that would then say, okay, based on the testimony, here's what we believe. But that, you know, the testimony has been primarily regarding the interpretation, which is a question of law, and we've submitted our briefs. So I don't see any need for a written argument. I'm happy to make oral argument.
Mr. Gorey?
I would actually take the opposite tack, Your Honor. I'd prefer written closings and these are legal issues. I don't, you know, the testimony I think was helpful to an extent, but I think these, you know, there's a lot swirling around here, and I think some, you know, solid analysis in the, you know, in the calm of our respective offices, I think would be very helpful to you. I would also note that, you know, as the appellant, we did the opening brief and then the city replied. We did not have an opportunity to submit a reply, which was fine. I'm all for streamlined procedure, but I would point out that I have not had an opportunity to formally, you know, respond to the city's arguments. I've been trying to develop some testimony today, but I have not had that opportunity. I would appreciate that opportunity because I think the city's response to both of our briefs, interveners and appellants, you know, raised issues, and then we haven't been able to formally respond. And I think writing would be a much more fruitful way for both intervener and appellant to do that.
So, Mr. Gorey, how about this? Pitch me on a method here. What would you like to have happen if we stopped right now? What's the deadlines? What's the procedure?
Today's Thursday. I don't think it would take too long. I'd maybe do Monday.
Well, I'd give yourself more time than that, but I'm asking, do you want simultaneous?
Nancy doesn't like that.
Would you want simultaneous submission of briefs? Do you want briefs to come in an order? I prefer simultaneous submission. Yep. I know lawyers always want the last word, but.
Yeah, give us all the last word, all simultaneous. Otherwise, I don't think it's fair. We're back to the issue of not being able to respond.
Back and forth, yeah. So I would, okay. So I would say, you know, next Friday to me would be more reasonable rather than Monday. I'm getting nodding from Nancy.
Wish my luck.
But I'd be fine with that. So, Mr. Haney, any thoughts on that?
You know, the deadline is I guess, fine. I think we've, you know, I'm trying to think of what more I can add to
you can rest on
obviously
your
cogent reading. Legal analysis that I've already presented to the examiner. So
Mr. Haney has already delivered so much legal analysis that he can't fathom including any more. In that case, you are welcome to rest on the brief that you have already submitted, Mr. Haney. It's purely optional to
I will certainly look at the testimony and see if there is anything that we want to add. If the examiner desires that. As I say, I'm prepared to make oral argument. I was prepared to make oral argument today and to just
You always are, and I appreciate that. And then every time you see me, I throw you the same curveball of preferring it written, but I do appreciate you. You're ready every time. So my suggestion then would be today being, the 23rd. So we're looking at, it would be the 1st, August. Is that right?
I think that's right. Oh, yeah, no, 31st.
The 31st. 31st is Friday. Probably. 1st is Saturday.
Yeah. Thank you. So it'd be August. It'd be July 31st. Let's say, 4 p.m. Everyone that so desires, let's put page limits. What's a reasonable page limit on this?
Double-spaced pages. I don't know.
15?
8 to 10, I don't know.
10, perfect.
Okay.
A double-spaced closing brief, no longer than 10 pages, purely optional for those that are concerned that they haven't already exhausted all the brilliance that they intended on exhausting. I kid, Mr. Haney, I do appreciate it. You were ready. But does that make sense to everyone? So the briefs, and they could be, let's be clear, submit them electronically. I don't need hard copies. I don't believe the city needs a hard copy. Carla, if you can weigh in on that, I don't think the city needs a hard copy.
No, you can just send me it via email and digitally, that's fine.
Yeah, so everyone that, again, if you're not going to submit something, at least tell the other parties that you're not submitting anything. But that will say 4 p.m. Friday, the 31st, at which point the record will close and I will produce a decision within two weeks, 10 business days of that would be my plan. So I think then we can stop for the day. Is that accurate?
I believe so.
Well, thank you, guys. I know it's a challenging way to do this via remote meeting technology, especially for a complex appeal, but we got through it, I think, relatively painlessly. And I thank everyone for your professionalism, the attorneys and all of the members of city staff that were involved. And thank you to the applicant that participated as well. And I wish everyone good health moving forward, obviously. Stay safe. And I think then we can go ahead and end the recording. Ms. Lundgren, if people want a copy of the recording,